Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
There's so many variables with fermentation, and because it's a long process and there's many different components of it and they're living and how they interact with each other is delicate. It's definitely an art and a science.
Janine Buescher makes kombucha. She wanted to grow her homebrew into commercial production, but she found out that there's no standard way to do that with kombucha, so she and other homebrewers have had to get creative. We'll hear about the push to grow wheat research with Harvest Public Media, time to invest in a pizza stone for Daniel Orr's Thin Crust Pizzas. In Nebraska, a new program lets farmers buy and sell rights to groundwater, and throwing a party for an apple orchard. Wassailing with Maria Kennedy. Some stories from this week's news, some that made headlines right before the new year. Here's Mark Chilla.
We saw the government's new dietary guidelines this week. Some points aren't new. Eat more fruits and vegetables, more whole grains, and cut back on salt. One notable addition is about sugar consumption. The guidelines say we should limit our sugar to no more than 10% of our daily calories. Many Americans consume up to 22 teaspoons a day, so to meet that new target, they'd need to cut that number almost in half. The new guidelines also removed a long-standing recommendation to limit cholesterol from foods to 300 milligrams a day. Something that didn't make the list was a recommendation on meat consumption. The final guidelines do not include anything specific about how much red or processed meat we should be eating. Farms hit by bird flu in 2015 are still recovering. But as Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, officials predict it's a matter of when, not whether, another outbreak will occur.
Midwest egg and turkey farms were hit hard, and 48 million birds were killed in the spring 2015 bird flu outbreak. The fall wild bird migration did not bring the deadly virus back, but worried farmers remain on alert. Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Bill Northey says both state and federal officials are better prepared to respond quickly when the virus returns.
Folks are resigned that there's going to be a greater likelihood in the future, but maybe the future is 5 or 10 years from now, maybe the future is next spring.
Northey says one change is that farmers will be able to hire local crews to empty and clean barns instead of waiting on USDA to do it. But USDA has also placed more staff in states with large poultry operations. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Consumer groups say the fight over country of origin labels on meat is far from over. Late last year, before the winter recess, Congress voted to roll back a law requiring stores to display an animal's country of origin for pork and beef. The move followed a decision from the World Trade Organization in early December, allowing Canada and Mexico to demand $1 billion in tariffs from the U.S. for violating trade rules unless Congress repealed the law. So it did. They said the practice was discriminatory against imported products, and meat packers in the U.S. complained the law is costly to implement. The repeal is a blow to consumer groups pushing for more transparency. Winona Hauter, executive director of Food and Water Watch, said the group would redouble efforts in the new Congress to reinstate country of origin labeling. She added in an email statement that Congress discarded more than was needed from the label law, including rules for ground meats that the WTO had already ruled was legal, a move she called, quote, a holiday gift to the meatpacking industry from Congress, unquote. And for years, the antibiotic colistin was known as the best chance to combat antibiotic resistance. But journalist Marin McKenna says there's bad news. Researchers have discovered a gene that confers resistance to the drug, and they found it in livestock, meat sold in stores, and even in humans. McKenna says that the use of colistin dates back to the beginning of the antibiotic era in the 1940s. Because it's an old drug, it has remained cheap to dose. Researchers believe resistance to colistin has built up in part due to its wide use in livestock in China. There are more details to read about these three stories. You can see them posted on our website, or you can dig through our Twitter feed to find the links. Either way, you should take a look at eartheats.org.
Great. Thanks, Mark.
Anytime.
We'll be right back. Seed companies have poured billions of dollars into research and development for high-tech soybeans and corn that raises more grain with less water. Farmers are flocking to new varieties of these crops, and that has left the wheat industry struggling to keep up. Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media reports on a push to grow wheat research.
This field of wheat by Ogallala in western Nebraska doesn't look like the waving grain you might think of. As winter settles in, it looks more like an uncut lawn. Still, this bright patch of green stands out in the wide brown winter landscape. The wheat industry would like to see more patches of wheat out here. Over the last couple decades, wheat has literally been losing ground as farmers turn more acres over to crops like corn and soybeans.
We've seen a decline in acres of production, for the last 25 years.
Steve Yale is director of research with the National Association of Wheat Growers.
The farmer can make more money producing other crops, particularly corn and soybeans, than wheat.
Wheat is one of the world's staple foods and a big crop on the Great Plains, but it's been left in the dust. A corn farmer can grow over 40% more corn per acre than she could 30 years ago. The gain in wheat is less than half that. Yale says the fix is to revitalize wheat research.
We need more resources applied to breeding technology, soil health, fungicides, chemistry, weed control. We need a lot of work to be done in wheat that's currently not going on.
One way the wheat industry could catch up is with wheat hybrids. Hybrids are made by crossing two parent plants instead of allowing them to self-pollinate. If they're compatible, you can see a jump in yield over conventional breeding. Hybrid corn has been around about 100 years. At the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, researchers are trying to make it work for wheat. Inside a greenhouse, tables are topped with rows of potted wheat plants. Plant breeder Steven Benziger grabs a stem and bends it down to take a closer look.
We're transferring the hybrid system that was used in spring wheats in Australia to hard red and hard white winter wheats that'll be grown in Nebraska.
Then they can start testing hundreds of combinations of wheat varieties to see which ones create a hybrid bump. There's a lot of trial and error, and Benziger says wheat is at a huge disadvantage in research manpower.
There are about 120 breeders in wheat in the U.S. There's 800 breeders in corn. You would expect greater gains.
Hybrid wheat research needs another 5 or 10 years, but if it works, it could be a boost for farmers and for seed companies.
When you have hybrid seed, you buy new seed every year. Whereas wheat traditionally has had a lot of farmer-save seed, so that makes the market attractive.
That's one reason for seed companies like Syngenta or Bayer or DuPont to focus on wheat research. Another is that hybrids are a first step toward genetically modified wheat. There is no GMO wheat on the market today, but it could help fight off weeds and diseases. But are wheat farmers looking for hybrids and GMOs? Michael Thomas farms wheat, soybeans, and corn near Ogallala, Nebraska. He's seen how research can pay off.
These corn varieties, you know, have certainly made them yield more and get by with less water, and it's fairly miraculous, really.
But Thomas is cautious about going the biotech route with wheat. Given the resistance many people have toward GMOs, even though scientists say they're safe, Thomas isn't sure they're worth the risk.
I, of course, use biotech soybeans and alfalfa and corn. I don't have any reservations about just the idea of biotech, but it's just, I just don't know if it's going to be like a magic bullet that's going to fix some of the issues that we have in the wheat industry.
And the main issue Thomas is concerned about is demand. The gluten-free craze has people eating less bread. That's hurt wheat prices. Couple that with a research gap, and many farmers are switching to corn.
With wheat, it's worth more per bushel, but you produce less bushels.
How to raise more wheat and make more money for farmers is what researchers have to figure out if the industry wants to keep from losing more ground. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Coming up from Harvest, in some parts of Nebraska, regulators are cracking down on farmers that use too much groundwater to irrigate their crops. Kombucha is a fermented black or green tea. It's a probiotic drink made in small batches, usually at home. The fermentation process makes it fizzy, tastes a little vinegary, and it's all the rage in the natural food sector right now. According to Euromonitor, sales of ready-to-drink carbonated tea, which includes many kombucha brands, jumped from about $120 million in 2009 to well over $500 million 5 years later. That's especially striking because the drink has only been widely available commercially for about 20 years. There's no standard way to scale up homebrew to industrial production. As we learn from a couple kombucha brewers, they've had to make it up as they've gone along, with mixed results. Alicia Sweet is getting ready to make a new batch of kombucha. She pulls a SCOBY out of its holding tank, her SCOBY Hotel, which is a 6-gallon glass bucket. The SCOBY looks like a floppy, squishy, frisbee-shaped thing. It's pretty gross. But this is the key to turning regular old sweet tea into kombucha.
Do 4 cups, so a quart of tea, and then 1 cup of sugar. It feeds off the caffeine and the sugar, the SCOBY.
SCOBY, by the way, is an acronym for Symbiotic Colony of Bacteria and Yeast. Alicia has been making kombucha for 10 years. At her most prolific, she was brewing 10 gallons at a time in her home. These days, it's much smaller batches in individual mason jars.
This right here is raspberry. It brewed for like a week and a half, not even a full 2 weeks. After I tasted it and it was like fizzy, that's when you bottle it. When you bottle it and put it in a temperature colder than 70 degrees, it's called hibernation. At that point is when I start adding fruit.
Oh, it's mild.
It's only one day after, so like...
And the fizz is really light in that, too. It'll get fizzier the longer it sits.
It'll get fizzier the longer it stays in the fridge, and it will get more fruity the longer it stays in there.
She's a restaurateur with her husband. They opened King Dough, a pizza joint in Bloomington, Indiana, just 4 months ago. As they were planning the drink menu, she saw an opportunity to bring her kombucha to the business.
At the restaurant, we were like, what are we going to do with all these taps? And we were like, are we going to do a non-alcoholic beer? Because we were like, we don't want to do any bottled beverages. And we decided instead of that, why not do kombucha? Because we all drink kombucha. We all know how to brew it. We all love it.
But what they didn't know was how to scale up their home brewing.
All of these, including beer and wine and everything, all come initially from a home brewer process that has over time evolved into commercial industries.
Hannah Crum is the president of Kombucha Brewers International. Part of the trouble home brewers run into with scaling up their production is there isn't equipment specifically made to accommodate the unique requirements of kombucha.
So, for instance, kombucha really, it requires oxygen as part of the fermentation process, at least initially, which is why you see everyone online with their little cloth-covered jars. But the problem with that is if you have a vessel that's too deep, you don't allow the oxygen to penetrate all the way to the bottom of the brew, and that can cause culture drift and several other things.
So brewers have had to get creative.
It was a roller coaster ride.
It still is.
It still is.
The hardest part about scaling up kombucha is that nobody has done it and written about it.
That's Sarah Schomber and Janine Busher, co-founders of Bucci. Their facility is in rural Weaverville, North Carolina.
It's not like making a batch of cookies where you can just increase everything. There's so many variables with fermentation, and because it's a long process and there's many different components of it and they're living, and how they interact with each other is very
delicate.
It's definitely an art and a science.
They went from homebrew to commercial production in 2009. Demand in nearby Asheville was immediate and relentless. In the beginning, they were capped at brewing 60 gallons of kombucha a week because that's all their equipment would allow. They did some research into the beer, cider, and even yogurt industries and pieced together an equipment upgrade. Then the kombucha crisis of 2010 hit. That's when officials tested kombucha and discovered some bottles being sold at Whole Foods contained more than 0.5% alcohol. As a result, Whole Foods pulled kombucha from its shelves nationwide. Janine says the kombucha crisis inspired them to make another big investment.
And the equipment in order to test at our own facility was like $20,000.
With the help of their $60,000 bottling line, Bucci now distributes to around 650 retailers in 20 states. As Alicia was sketching out her kombucha plan for King Dough, she wasn't worried about the financial cost. Her concern was how much time it would take to brew enough for the restaurant.
There's a lot of upkeep of it. Every 2 weeks, you have to make more. And we had like 5 batches going at a time.
To stretch the kombucha, she came up with a blend of ginger juice and white grape juice to mix in.
The staff loved it.
But really, the main problem for us, the downfall of our kombucha altogether, was it just wasn't selling.
So they've taken it off the menu. That 13th tap that's now open, they'll probably offer another beer. Because Alicia says people love the tried and true combination of beer and pizza. You can see a picture of Alicia Sweet holding her gigantic SCOBY hotel at eartheats.org. And speaking of pizza...
Now, with these thin-crusted pizzas, what you don't want to do is to overload them, all right? Because you want that crust to stay really crisp and to be able to pick it up without having all of your toppings fall off.
Less is more with Daniel Orr's thin-crust pizzas. His recipe coming up. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. When you go a-wassailing, you could be doing one of two things. There's the house visiting wassail, which is the practice of singing carols door-to-door during the Christmas season. The other type of wassailing is the orchard visiting variety. That's Maria Kennedy's bread and butter.
I went to my first wassail at the Lempster Morris Wassail.
She worked with cider makers in England as part of her studies in folklore at Indiana University. She was one of 300 people at that wassail.
I showed up at this pub in pretty much the middle of nowhere in a little village in the north part of the county of Herefordshire. They led us all out to the orchard, carrying torches and banging drums.
And singing, lots of singing. The noisy procession into the apple orchards is meant to wake up the trees and scare away evil spirits.
Some people actually beat the tree with a stick. And they poured some cider on the roots of the tree to give it back some of the juice it had produced.
Wassails are traditionally held on either the evening of January 5th, Twelfth Night, or on January 17th, which is the date of Old Twelfth Night, before the introduction of the Gregorian calendar in 1752. Kennedy helped revive the wassailing tradition on Broom Farm in Herefordshire when she was there in 2012. In addition to the singing and noisemaking and general merriment,
we built 12 little fires around the biggest apple tree. And the 12 fires are said to represent either the 12 months of the year or the 12 apostles. Then you build a 13th fire, which is the Judas fire. And you're supposed to stamp out the Judas fire.
What kind of songs are you singing?
There are a number of traditional wassail songs. There's the Gloucestershire wassail.
Wassail, wassail all over the town. Our bread it is white and our ale it is brown. Our bowl it is made of a white maple tree. We'll wassail and bowl the cream to thee.
It's hard to know how long people have been wassailing, but it likely originated long before Christianity came to Britain, since 600 AD. Kennedy says it was traditionally done by agricultural laborers.
And it's kind of like a contract, almost. The laborers are saying, you know, if you treat us well and give us stuff to eat, both symbolically and actually, like they're going to give you some cakes and some things to eat tonight, and hopefully for the rest of the year, you're going to pay us well and be a good employer. And we're going to, in exchange, sing to your trees and make sure they're going to bear a lot of fruit.
And then it's back to the fields the following week for what's called Plow Monday. These days, Kennedy says wassailing is a good excuse for a party right before the work starts up again.
You have to think, like, it's really dark in England. in the middle of winter. It's rainy and it's cold and it's really dark all the time. And then you get to like get together with a group of people and light some torches and go out in the orchard and sing some songs and bang some pots and drink a lot of cider.
Maria Kennedy studied folklore at Indiana University. She worked on orchards in the cider-making region of England, and she spoke with us last year around this time. You can listen to more at eartheats.org. Water is at a premium in many plains states. A new program for sharing Nebraska's groundwater may help both farmers and endangered species. For Harvest Public Media, Ariana Brocious reports on a new program trying to take some of the headache out of water transfers.
In many parts of Nebraska, farmers have used too much groundwater to irrigate their crops. A decade ago, the state began limiting the amount of new groundwater farmers can use. Lyndon Vogt is general manager of the Central Platte Natural Resources District, which stretches about 175 miles along the Platte River in south-central Nebraska. The district wants to help farmers share the groundwater they already have more easily.
We have so much use in our district right now, and in part of our district that's sustainable. We're okay with that use being moved around a little bit as long as it's a sustainable use.
The district is starting a groundwater leasing program. It will help farmers buy and sell each other's groundwater supplies, but it won't be permanent, just temporary. Duke University economist David McAdams designed the computer algorithm for the leasing process called the Groundwater Exchange Program.
You have an opportunity, if you're a farmer, to lease out your water rights or buy more water rights just for 1 year.
The program relies on existing modeling of river and groundwater flows to track the water from one farmer to another and track the impact on the river.
What the market will do is figure out the fair market clearing price for groundwater at each location in the Central Platte to ensure that we get the most value from the water and to ensure that we continue having ample stream flow in the Platte.
That's important because excessive groundwater pumping can lead to lower stream flows, which threaten habitat for endangered birds like the whooping crane and least tern. To help river flows, since 2007, Central Platte Natural Resources District has been buying up permanent irrigation groundwater rights, but not using them, leaving that water in the ground. Vogt hopes this new program will help reduce the need to do that.
It seems kind of a waste to me that we take some of the most productive land in the world out of production permanently to assist stream flow when possibly we could go through this leasing process.
One environmental group says they plan to lease irrigation water rights through this new program and leave the water in the system to help the endangered species they're working to protect. The program could also help farmers like Andrew Wadacheski. He grows corn and soybeans, relying mostly on groundwater irrigation. He plans to be a water buyer.
This will give me a chance to put some irrigated water on some dry land property that previously hasn't produced too well because it's dry land. So this will give producers like me a real good chance to get a good crop.
The Groundwater District hopes the program will drive water to its most beneficial use. For example, someone who uses water for flood irrigation on a small field may sell that water to another farmer who will use it for more efficient sprinkler irrigation. Wadacheski says the flexibility of these short-term leases should help both younger and older farmers.
Maybe some of them have some extra water that they've certified in the past and don't necessarily want to sell that right, but would be willing to lease it out. And for younger guys like I, who couldn't afford to purchase the high-quality farm ground, this will get us a good spot for him to create a little extra revenue to rent the acres out and for me to be able to irrigate my crop.
Trading groundwater on a temporary basis is still a new idea. A couple other water-strapped districts in Nebraska and Kansas have implemented similar programs. Colorado is piloting temporary trading of surface water irrigation. In Nebraska, water manager Lyndon Vogt says the success of the groundwater exchange program remains to be seen.
The nice thing about it is if we do this for 1 year or we do it for 5 years and we decide it's not having the effect we think, all we have to do is quit doing it and everything goes back the way it is today.
But Vogt hopes that more flexible water rights systems could help farmers, cities, and industries work more effectively with their water supply. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Ariana Brocious.
Get to know the work of this reporter collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. Pizza party with Daniel Orr. He made the dough ahead of time and sectioned them out into small portions so all of us could create our own little mini pizzas. Very cool. He has a $20,000 pizza oven at his disposal. Most of us mortals do not have that. So go ahead and get yourself a pizza stone. Yes, they do make a difference. The stones help pull water out of the crust, which means you won't have that gooey, undercooked part in the middle of the pizza. All right, I'm thinking about my toppings while Chef Daniel preps the dough.
The first thing we do is we take a little bit of olive oil and we put that on top of the pie dough. And what that does is it creates a little seal. Okay, so I'm going to follow the olive oil up with some red sauce. Now, with these thin-crusted pizzas, what you don't want to do is to overload them, all right, because you want that crust to stay really crisp and to be able to pick it up without having all of your toppings fall off. So it's very important you don't do too much sauce. Okay, and then you can look over here, and we have some of the wide variety of items that we can put on the pizzas. We have local sausage, we have pineapple, we've got kielbasa, we've got pesto, we've got mozzarella, fresh mozzarella.
So many options, including mashed potatoes. I almost went for the sauerkraut, which Daniel says he would have combined with kielbasa and smoked mozzarella for their Oktoberfest pie.
Grated chocolate and some mascarpone cheese, maybe some fresh fruit on that.
But I decided to keep it sort of traditional with pineapple. I guess in my world, that's considered a traditional pizza topping. Anyway, he did some thinking and came up with what he's calling the spicy Latino pizza pie.
Okay, so we have the pineapple. I'm going to chop up some chicken. And then we're going to put on what is called a sofrito, which is a Puerto Rican pesto. Okay, and then we're going to sprinkle some jalapenos. We're going to put a little Parmesan. Then we've got some smoked Gouda. Okay, and then we put it on the pizza peel. What I like to do is to have it get a little bit brown and crunchy around the outside, a little bit of chard. I think that really adds to the flavor. The inside's going to be a little bit less cooked. Now, with the spicy Latino, I like to garnish it with some nice big sprigs of cilantro, which you can kind of wrap around the pizza. And then we put lime wedge on it. Okay, we're just going to cut it up into nice little bites.
Oh, this was great. He also shared his wild mushroom pizza with us and a heavy on the veggies pizza. We've listed the ingredients for those at eartheats.org. And if you're a visual learner, be sure to click through the photo slideshow of Daniel Orr rolling out the dough and getting everything all set. Earth Eats is a collaboration with several folks at WFIU Bloomington, including Eabon Binder, Mark Chilla, Betsy Shepard, and Daniel Orr. Chad Bouchard and Liz Leslie write our news stories, and the reporters at Harvest Public Media keep us connected with farmers all over the country. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. We are ready for a good start to the new year. Hope you're well. I'm Annie Corrigan.